KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Good in the Hood from Friday, June 24th through Sunday, June 26th at King School Park in Portland. Good in the Hood is an annual three-day benefit festival celebrating unity in the community. Festivities include live music, food, and a parade. Again, that's Good in the Hood from Friday, June 24th through Sunday, June 26th at King School Park, 4815 Northeast 7th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is looking for our next membership director. KBOO's members are the heart and soul of our community, and we need a dedicated person to honor and foster this relationship. Are you the right person to steward and manage KBOO's membership department, or do you know someone who is? Go to kboo.fm to learn more about the essential functions of the membership director and the qualifications we are looking for. You can also apply by mailing your resume and cover letter to KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Members make KBOO happen. Help us show them how much they do.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. On today's show, we want to talk about trauma and resilience, and especially trauma as it pertains to young people, kids. We have a guest who specializes in this area. He's well known around the country. His name is Bruce D. Perry. He's a senior fellow at the Child Trauma Academy, which is a nonprofit organization based in Houston. You can reach them at childtrauma.org. He's also a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Northwestern University School of Medicine in Chicago. We could go on and on, but he is the author of several books. One is called The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. The other one is called Born for Love. And the one that we want to talk about is What Happened to You? Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing. And his co-author is none other than Oprah Winfrey. So welcome to the show, and how are you doing?
Thank you very much. I'm all right, all things considered.
You're in two hot spots, you know, where we want to talk about trauma and how it relates to young people. You're in Chicago, which is frequently held up as, you know, this is a place where bad things happen because of the violence that is often shown. I don't know if it's the most violent place, but it's definitely, in terms of political arenas, it's the discussion that everybody
gets a lot of attention.
But then also your organization is based down in Texas. And when we reached out to get you on the show, the tragedies that happened in Uvalde had not occurred. And right. here we are in the midst of people getting funerals and the whole nine. As our audience here knows, you know, I have, you know, my mother-in-law and my sisters-in-law teach in Texas, and they're not far from that area. You know, they're about half hour, maybe an hour away, depending on which city. So that hits close to home in the sense that you're around, you know, that sort of energy of teachers, and you see the pictures, and they all teach, you know, kids in that grade, you know, third, fourth. My wife is a kindergarten teacher, and when I see the pictures of the kids in her class, it's hard to distinguish those kids, those black and brown kids, in this case, mostly brown kids in Uvalde, from the ones I see in the picture. And then, of course, I have my own elementary age kids as well. I bring that up to say the events as they unfolded and what we're learning is traumatic for me. You know, it's hurtful.
There's no doubt about it. It's very, you know, when you asked me how I was doing, if I would have told you the truth, I would have said I'm burned out. I'm exhausted because our team has been working both with the Ukrainian refugee situation and with all of the other things that we do across this country. But then more recently with Uvalde, you know, the community there, I've spoken with several of the parents, which is just a heartbreaking experience. And even just watching the news, I think for most people is overwhelming. You know, I know that I've seen multiple people that I know in my sphere of influence who will start talking about it and then just say, I can't talk about it anymore. We got to, you know, I can't watch the news anymore. I don't want to think about it anymore. I've had four or five people tell me that they wake up in the middle of the night thinking about it. And like you said, the common denominator is it's people who have children or grandchildren or family members that teach, and just this can be very overwhelming and traumatizing, even if you're not there.
No, it is, and that's on top of Buffalo.
Yeah, which is
so so for me, I see grandparents and grandmas and that was heartbreaking enough. And I bring all this up, I don't want to center it on me, but just to give people a context. If I'm feeling this as somebody who is, I'm not in Uvalde, I'm not in Buffalo, and I know, you know, the information that is coming is heart-wrenching, I can only imagine the people who actually experienced it. And this is where you and your work come in. And to a large degree, this is what your book is focused on, at least giving us an idea to understand this. So one, let me just ask the basic question since we started talking about these tragedies. Maybe you can paint a picture and walk us through what somebody who was in third or fourth grade, who was in that classroom, who woke up today and like more than half their class is being buried, they're gone. That must be crazy. And then, you know, we focus on that, but then you also in Chicago. So that's a thing that is highlighted every day. You know, one day you have friends there, the next day you don't. I don't, you know.
It becomes, you know, one of the things that over the years that we've seen and tried to study a little bit is the ways in which our mind allows us to sort of adapt to the incomprehensible.
Right.
And there's a defense mechanism, sort of an adaptation that we all can use, and we all do use it at different times. And it's called, we refer to it as dissociation. And that kind of is this disconnection from the emotional intensity of the moment. And it allows you to almost be in parallel with your pain. You observe it, and you can do that for a while, but part of the problem is that always breaks through. You know, you just, you can't stay there forever. And if you do stay there forever, then you start to have other kinds of problems where I think everybody's listening knows what it's like to be in a conversation with somebody when you feel like they're really present, like right. they're really listening. It's a, it has a whole different quality than somebody who's just sort of showing there. Up.
Right.
And so if you're a kid in class, or if you're a kid who's dissociated because you're coping with the images of what happened to you last week, you're not going to be able to be present to benefit from that kind of real true moment that people have. And you're not going to be able to be present to fully learn the cognitive concept that's being taught in class. And so pretty soon you start to socially disengage and you start to academically fall behind. And it's, you know, believe it or not, it was originally referred to as zombieism.
Really?
You know, yeah, wow. Way back, the same guy that coined the term fight or flight coined the term zombieism, because people who were equally distressed and were kind of just robotically going through the motions of life, but they weren't fully embracing and engaging in life. And that's one of the heartbreaking things that happens with these kids. Is
right. And this is not just pertaining to kids. As you were talking, use that word disassociation. I have a friend who, you know, went through a horrific, you know, scenario where they were brutally raped. And this word came up, and you know, from what we were learned is that in order to survive what happened, they literally went into a, they became almost like another person, but it was but behavior situations were showing up. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I would only imagine a lot of people, when they go through trauma, you guess you said you're working with people in the Ukraine, that must be a common sort of thing that pops up.
Absolutely. It's probably the most common form of stress response when you're in a situation that is unavoidable and is emotionally or physically painful. And so if you think about some of the photographs you may have seen of the people who are looking, you just look stunned. They just look kind of like, they kind of have that glazed look.
Hence that's the name, a dissociative. Zombieism.
Yeah, that's exactly it. They're dissociated. And it's one of these things that is a great adaptive capability in the moment, but over time it becomes maladaptive. And so, like I said, it interferes with relationships. And so the next time somebody, if you use that adaptation a lot, it's like any brain related function, if you do it a lot, you get better at it. And so the next time, you know, a year later, if one of these kids is confronted with a stress like having to get up and recite a poem in front of his peers, instead of being able to do it, they may just zone out and just, you know, fail. And you know, the other part of this is that people, I think, probably are beginning to connect the dots about is that as you get older and you realize that that's a place where you feel safe or you don't feel any pain, and you get introduced to an opiate, all of a sudden you go, hey, this is an easy way to dissociate. This is an easy way to deal with that. And so you're at greater risk for overusing alcohol or pot or opiates or other drugs that kind of help you get to that place where there's no pain. And then, of course, there's all the secondary consequences of that.
Right. Dr. Perry, Bruce Perry is our guest. When you said that this disassociation tactic is one that can often be used, are we to understand you don't choose to do that, right? Is this something that kicks in? I want to make sure our listeners, you know, like, you know, because people are quick to say, you made a choice, Dave. You made a choice to, you know, but this is something that is almost reflexive, and I don't know, do people realize they're doing it, or they just know that if they stand a certain way and they feel better, they continue to
you know, that's a great question, because there's kind of both versions.
Okay.
In the beginning, your body does it for you, because you just don't, you're just so overwhelmed. And then later on, you sometimes, not always, but sometimes discover ways to get there easier. So for example, cutting. You know, you've probably heard about kids that cut themselves.
Right.
If you cut, that's a way to sort of activate that sensitized, that overly reactive dissociative response. So some people do learn to actually go to those places more easily by using some of these techniques. You know, there's the other thing that, and not all of the routes to this place are unhealthy. So for example, there are a lot of people who learn that when they sit and draw, they can kind of get lost in their head and they go to a safer place and they feel regulated and they don't feel as much pain. And that's that helps them dissociate. So they'll go write, they'll do their poems, or they'll listen to their music.
Right.
Or there are a number of other healthier ways to get there.
Right.
But most people are not as consciously aware that they don't say, hey, I'm going to sit down and dissociate now, so let me do my art. They go, I know that when I do my art, it helps me deal with all this crap.
Right. So I would imagine meditation would be a path, prayer for others. You know, you often see people go, why are you praying? And I don't know if people who are always skeptical about that really don't understand that people find a lot of solace in that.
Absolutely. And you know, meditative prayer and a variety of sort of mindfulness related exercises, and people who do, you know, you can learn certain self-hypnotic techniques that allow you to intentionally go to that place.
Right.
And again, there's, you know, people that are competitive athletes or performers on stage learn these little rituals that help them get to that place to prepare for performance under duress.
Right. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Dr. Bruce Perry. He has a book, What Happened to You? It's dealing with conversations about trauma, resiliency, and related issues. In your book, and you know, I'm kind of working my way backwards a little bit, but we started off with this discussion of trauma. You have a whole chapter that talks about spectrums of trauma. And that's a word that is now used. That's a buzzword. So it's traumatic. It's traumatic that I didn't get to, you know, the PlayStation. It's traumatic that me and my girl broke up. It's traumatic with what the kids in Uvalde are going through. It's traumatic what the people in Buffalo are going through. We all use the same word, but there are wide-ranging differences, or for the people that's experienced it, is it all the same, you know, in terms of their reaction and coping, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe talk to us a little bit about that.
Let's talk about that, because you're hitting on a couple of really important points here. One of the key things is we do use that word like too much, kind of like love. You know, I love chocolate and I love my grandson, but they're not the same thing.
Right.
From my perspective, kind of studying this as a someone interested in the stress response and how the body and the mind deal with overwhelming experiences, trauma is when the event, whatever it is causes such an intense internal response that the person can't get back to their previous baseline. So it sort of it changes you. Trauma shifts you. And it usually shifts you in a direction that makes you more vulnerable. It makes life harder for you. And so, when you think about it, then there's a lot of different aspects to that. That, you know, you can, if you are a particularly sensitive person, you can have an experience that another person would go, "What's the big deal?"
Right.
But that might make you feel so overwhelmed that it causes these enduring changes. Let me give you an example. I know somebody, you know, there's a lot of people that have autism, for example.
Right.
And one of the dilemmas of autism is that they get sensory overloaded so easily. And when they get sensory overloaded, when the environment changes too much and there's too much noise, and you know, like if they go to the zoo or a birthday party, for example,
right,
their brain literally, the stress response is so overactive that it becomes a potentially traumatic experience. Whereas most of us think about going to the zoo when you're 8 years old as like kind of an adventure, you know, it's kind of interesting, it's fun. But because of the way they're organized, that event becomes overwhelming.
Right.
And this is a really important thing. And one of the things that I think is so crucial about this concept, and I'm glad you brought it up, is that if you are a person of color living in a dominant culture, you have a long history of getting these little nonverbal signals and sometimes verbal signals and other cues that you don't quite belong, that you're not quite one of us. And so what happens is you can go into an interaction with somebody, and if you have, if that person is dismissive of you or minimizes you, now watching that externally, if somebody goes, well, they were just rude to you, or, you know, I can see where you would interpret it that, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is, because of that long catalog of experience, that is an overwhelmingly dysregulating experience. And so all kinds of kids that we work with that are brown and black kids that are living in a dominant culture are continually getting these nonverbal signals that they're not quite, they don't quite belong. Or there are other, whether it's through the media, whether it's through the way the educational testing system is set up, whether it's through any variety of sort of pre-existing structures that continue to send that message, they develop this a sensitization to minimizing, marginalizing actions. And so if somebody treated me that way, coming from the dominant culture, coming from a privileged, stable, economically decent, you know, predictable environment, I can say, oh, they're just a rude asshole,
right?
But if you have a sensitized stress response from a history of being marginalized, that can have a bigger impact on your stress response than on mine.
Right.
And I think that's a huge part of this.
How much of this is complicated, I'll use that word, by societal response? So, for example, a lot of attention is on Uvalde right now.
Yeah.
You know, money's flowing in, people are there, people are obviously caring, et cetera, et cetera. One would hope that if little Johnny and little Sally, next year when they go to school, it will be understood that they went through something that was horrific. And we need to give them space and time to heal. And what they went through is not normal. Contrast that with Chicago, where you're at. And, you know, little Johnny or little Sally witnessed a killing.
Yeah.
And there would be a perception of, well, let's get it together. You're from the hood. You know,
absolutely.
You get these types of things. And people may actually blame them. You know, for actually, you know,
what were you doing on the corner?
Right. Like, even though you're 8 years old, it was your parents' fault that you lived in the projects. So there's no real understanding. And I bring this up because little Johnny next year in Uvalde, if they act up in class, they'll be nurtured. But little Johnny in Chicago, if he acts up in class, will probably be suspended and then expelled.
Absolutely.
How do we start to deal with this? Because it seems like there's this societal, I don't know if it's trauma, but there's a societal interaction with traumatized people that make all the difference in the world.
It's so interesting that you bring, one of the things that we talk about in the book a little bit is the creation of your view of the world, right? Mm-hmm. And that when something shatters your view of the world, then that's traumatic.
Right.
So I'm going to tell you a story. When the week that Columbine happened, it was one of the first times that a sort of white suburban school, you know, school shooting happened. And it was, you may not, you probably remember because you're old enough.
Yeah.
But it was like front page day after day after day. It was like federal policy changes. It was tons of money, tons of attention, tons of focus. That same week, if you looked in the newspapers in Chicago, in New York, in Milwaukee, in a lot of the other cities, there were shootings at schools of black and brown kids that didn't even get any attention, none, because it wasn't considered to the public consciousness. It didn't shatter their worldview, because that's what's supposed to happen. What do you expect? And so to your point, and I try to bring this up every time I talk to the media, but they never want to bite with this. They never want to really present this. Everybody's giving these kids attention, and this is a horrific event. But already there have been as many shootings and as many kids exposed to violent acts of seeing classmates get shot in the U.S. in the last 5 days since Uvalde, more than there were in Uvalde.
Right.
And we're not hearing about that. And those kids are not going to get the resources and the teddy bears and the therapy dogs and the federal dollars and all the other stuff, because they don't live in the right neighborhood. And they're not the right, you know.
And this isn't the major story, because we have some odd, 200, 250 mass shootings this year.
Right.
This one we're focused on, but the other, the other ones we're not. It's funny.
Look at how fast Buffalo left the headlines.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, I'll bet you could go up to somebody in the street and say, "What happened in Buffalo a few weeks ago?" And half the people would go, "Oh, what are you talking about?"
Yeah. There's a couple of things, you know, that societal response, going back to Columbine, you know, the story that I remember about that is James Brown showed up. This is when I was at Clear Channel. Mm. Showed up unannounced to the station, wearing a blue suit. His bodyguard lives in the Bay Area, so I don't know why he was out of here, but he was here. And he came to the station, and he goes, it was 2 days after Columbine. He goes, "There's a lot of Columbines around the United States." And he goes, "Our kids are in trouble, and I want to talk to them. And I have a song, Stay in School." And I'll never forget that. He just showed up. And in those words, it's Columbines every day.
Yeah.
And what was crazy was he wasn't allowed on the airwaves. You know, the management at the time said James Brown doesn't have a hit record and wouldn't put him on. So I interviewed him and played the interview. You know, I had a little thing. And that interview was pulled and said James Brown has no relevancy to our audience. And I thought about this for years, and I tell the story because, you know, the station's an urban station. It's talking to mostly black and brown kids. Here's an elder. Here's somebody who's revered. Here's somebody who their whole format is based upon his musical ingenuity. You know, hip hop and all the urban music that we played was based on his signature sound. Was not allowed to address an audience and come there and show a love and an empathy and an understanding and even connect the dots the way that we're doing years later. But he wanted to do then. It's like, hey, man, you know, this is not the first time this sort of thing has happened. This is happening all the time, and we need to talk about it. And it's like, he doesn't have a hit record. He's not on the charts. Have a good day, Mr. Brown. I wonder how often that sort of intervention is stifled. You know, maybe it stifles your organization that deals with trauma. Maybe it stifles, you know, an actor like a Matthew McConaughey who went down to Uvalde, but maybe somebody in Chicago wants to go to the local school and they're going, "Nah, these kids will be all right."
Yeah. You know, as you're talking about that, what it reminds me of is something that I'm just beginning to understand. And I've kind of I've had sort of this tacit understanding of this. It's becoming clearer and clearer, in large part because of a number of scholars who've been writing about this. But every single system we have in our culture has its roots in colonialism. And just be, you know, the whole issue around not a hit record, it's money, it's power, it's dominance. Right. That has its carry forward even in your market. Your system is got a colonial sort of element to it.
Right.
And it's all about power. And power very rarely relinquishes power. It passes it to the next generation, to the right people, but it doesn't relinquish it. It doesn't distribute it, doesn't disseminate it. And so in that system, you know, when you have systems that care, that are built for and by people who have power, which in our society means you're white and you're male, and even though there are element, you know, there's little eroding away at that generation after generation, there's still the dominant superstructure right. of every system, education, child welfare, mental health, they're all, and academics, all these things still have that fundamental structure.
Yeah. And that was obvious that day, you know,
yeah.
Staff of color, listeners of color, white male on the top made the call. It's like there he's not go. Coming on our airwaves. Let me ask you this then, with that in mind, Dr. Bruce Perry. One, is this nation traumatized? And do traumatized people hurt other people? You know, yeah. that old saying, hurt breeds hurt. Yeah. Are we a traumatized nation? And the second part to that question, if we are dealing with constant instances that would in theory and in actuality bring about trauma, what happens when our response becomes so normalized that that is how we identify, this is who we are? So if I'm from a particular part of town, then I'm aggressive and that's how I see myself. Like I grew up like, no such thing as crying. We don't do that. You know, pops hit you in the chest, we don't cry, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. that's how I was raised. Now I'll cry, but you know, it took a long time to realize yeah. that is actually something that's healing more than it is, you know, making you a mark. But it was like, you don't cry. We don't cry in the household. That's not allowed. And that becomes a part of your, not only your identity, but sometimes even a badge. Like you kill somebody, something traumatic happens and I'll be very stoic. So yeah. I guess I'm asking you, using that as an example, how much of what we are seeing right now is now so firmly embedded in our day-to-day lives that these now become how we identify, and we may actually be really off what would ideally be the norm, or maybe yeah. it's a new norm. The
you
new
know,
norm I, is to be aggressive and combative or sullen and depressed, you know, all that sort of stuff.
It's so interesting that we're having this conversation, because this is one of the things that I'm trying to write about a little bit. And it kind of goes back to what we started talking about with dissociation,
mm-hmm.
that the brain's ability to kind of protect you from emotionally intense stuff involves that process. And it's a continuum. You know, you're not a zombie right away, but the first step on that continuum is to avoid any reminders or anything that would be distressing or whatever. So we look the other way, right? Which we do in this culture all the time, right?
Right.
So we look the other way. And then if you can't avoid looking the other way, you have an almost robotic compliance to what you're told is the right way, or that's the way we do things, that's the way things are.
Right.
And so what I think, with a lot of issues, there's sort of a cultural dissociation about the reality of how we became a nation.
Right.
And what we did to the indigenous peoples here, mm-hmm. and what we did with slavery and the relationship. And even now, you know, when people dare to suggest that we teach the real history.
Right.
There's a huge portion of the population that feels that that's challenging the worldview that we should maintain. Mm. And so they're pushing back and they're attacking
and legislating it out.
Exactly. But I do think that all of this is indicative of what you said earlier, that trauma is at the heart of this country. Trauma is part of the origin story. Trauma is part of the laws that we've created. Trauma, and as you also said, traumatized countries traumatize other countries. You know, we haven't been innocent in our expansionism. And if you look at the history of the United States, you know, we were bullies and aggressors and traumatizers to Mexico and to the British Empire and to anybody that got in our way.
Right.
And now I am hopeful that I don't believe that a traumatized person or a traumatized family or a traumatized community or a traumatized country has to carry forward everything in a negative way. You can learn and grow from your past experiences, but the key is you have to actually have insight. You have to look at it clearly. And this is why it's so important to teach the real history.
Right.
We're not going to be able to move forward as a healthier country unless we're able to sort of acknowledge how we got here. What happened to us? You know, what happened to this country that we ended up with these systems and that we ended up this way? You know, there were lots of good intentions that actually went badly. Like, you know, the good intention of building low-income housing in these high-rises in Chicago, that was well-intended, wasn't very smart, but it ended up having all kinds of secondary, tertiary problems. So let's tell the truth about that.
Right. One of the things in your book, What Happened to You, Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing. I wanted to make sure I got the full thing. That is written by Dr. Bruce D. Perry and Oprah Winfrey. And Bruce, Dr. Perry is our guest this afternoon. The thing that you focus on is kids in this book. And you shatter a couple of myths almost immediately, like damn near on the first couple of pages. Page one is like, well, you're young, you'll get over it. And I guess the studies are showing you don't get over it. Like that is where things are happening, you know, like, and let's speak to the mindset of the kid because they're picking this up. And I guess I'll complicate it a little bit more because now we're starting to study the kids that are on screens, you know, they're on iPads at an early age and it's right in front of them. And we're not, it's not a communal thing where we all watch TV. We all see Sesame Street. Yeah. My son is watching Sesame Street and I'm watching something else, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. But now from the shows that we've done and the experts that we've had on that have been in this, there's a certain there's an intentionality to program, to trigger particular types of emotions. Some of those emotions are to move people to be consumers. Some of those things that keep you locked into the screen, which in the end will net them more money. But the thing that stood out to me when we had one of our guests that does all this, he said the brain has actually changed in terms of how people take in information. So that's what I'm really curious from your standpoint, because you focus on the brain. But he said the work that they were doing at the United Nations was around brain function. He said it's changed, one, and he said two, we now have generations of kids who literally can't distinguish reality from what they're watching, you know, which is why these things can be harmful. So, you know, I'll give an example, maybe a critique, you know, Stranger Things is a very popular show. Right. You know, the kids love it. They have the exhibit. They've been watching it. The new season came out. That's not for kids. You know, the demonic stuff, all this occult stuff.
Oh, really?
But they're, you know, but they're watching this. And now, you know, like, I won't use the word traumatizing, but it's something that they don't want to watch it right now by themselves. Yeah. you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to watch it because it's like, why'd you go there? So let's talk a little bit about the stimuli, kids, and shatter some of those myths.
So one of the key things, and I think most grandparents, most parents have seen this, and that is that the brain is so sponge-like early in life.
Right.
I mean, the speed with which kids can change is amazing.
Right.
And they absorb things really rapidly, and that's because the brain is growing so rapidly early in life. And it means that the experiences of early life will have a disproportionate power to shape how their brain organizes, which is both good and bad. I mean, it's part of the wonderful quality of our species. Human beings are incredibly adaptive.
Right.
We can adapt to all kinds of different environments. And what's happened in the last generation is that we've created a whole new environment for the brain to adapt to, which, as you say, is very screen heavy and relationally impoverished, I would add, that most of our kids are having far fewer in-person conversations, less touch, less kind of what we would refer to sort of as non-structured social play.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, I like that word of relational poverty. And that too is at the root of what you're talking about a lot in the book.
Absolutely.
So let me just ask this question. And if I don't have that relationship, you know, if I'm impoverished in that way, does that make me desensitized to a lot of things? Just some killings.
It makes you less connected. So the whole part of your brain that's involved in empathy and compassion, kindness, you know, all the stuff we want for our kids, right? We want our kids to grow up with big hearts.
Right.
And we use this term big hearts, but really what we're talking about is part of the brain. That's the relational part of the brain. And it grows and develops just like any other part of your brain. It needs repetition. So if you don't hear words, you're not going to have a big vocabulary. And if you don't have relational interactions, you're not going to mature relationally. So
right.
You'll continue to have sort of a self-centered, self-absorbed view of the world. And if you think, you know, you're a parent. So there's a time when your child was really young and they're like, me, me, mine, 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 you know, and they're not good at sharing. And then as they get older, they get better at sharing and they mature.
Right.
But if you have somebody who's 25 years old, who's got the social sort of mindset of a four-year-old, they're gonna be out getting a job on Wall Street and they don't care about the consequences of making millions of dollars and contributing to the economic inequalities. And they'll just want a nicer watch and a nicer suit and, you know, $5,000 shoes and all that kind of stuff. And so that relational quality the lack of that relational quality does contribute to some of the stuff I think we're seeing. So,
well, one, can we recognize that in kids if we're just a layperson? I mean, I'm sure the book will help, you know, at least give people some sort of understanding. But will we recognize that to intervene? And if I am that 25-year-old guy on Wall Street who's been allowed to socialize that way, what can I do when I'm sitting there with a lot of power and financial decision-making ability and I go, I think these schools need to close. I think these salaries need to be decreased, you know?
That's kind of what's going on. I mean, honestly, right. That's what's going on. I mean, if you look at the inequity of income that's happened in the last decade, it's stunning.
Right.
And part of what happens with the development of this relational capability to be empathic and compassionate, it really requires relational interactions. And so what you'll find is the genetics of the human being. Human beings are intended to live in close proximity with other human beings. So there's a genetic pull to be connected. But if you have this immaturity, you feel this emptiness. And so a lot of people try to fill this emptiness with more things, right? And so they keep looking, Okay, I'm gonna do crystals, or I'm gonna do this, or I'm gonna do that. And there's an emptiness that they can't fill. And so there's this longing. And so this is why we literally have tried to help people think about relational wealth as something that's aspirational as opposed to material wealth.
Right. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the more you're connected to your family, to community, to culture, the more you volunteer, the more you spend time with people, laugh, eat meals with people, participate in your community, volunteer as a coach, all that kind of stuff, you will be physically healthier, you'll be socially more healthy, you'll be emotionally healthier, and you'll be more capable of dealing with stressors. The more vulnerable members of our society end up being the ones who are more marginalized. And relationally marginalized, and then if you combine that with economically marginalized, that's a really bad combination, and they're highly vulnerable to health problems and social problems and
right.
emotional problems.
Let me ask you this, that emptiness that people seem to be on a quest to fulfill, how much of that quest is found in us being addicted to our cell phones and social media, trying to find a connection? Now we're starting to see increasingly, like, I'm gonna order all kind of stuff I don't need off of Amazon because I'll get a package every day. Yeah. How much of that is triggering the emotions of feeling fulfilled? I don't know if it ever really triggers the full extent of the emotions, but you know, how is that? It seems like we're trying to fill some void.
Absolutely. And the irony is that there are people in our society that are happy to exploit that and promote materialism. And so it's this sort of, it's the death cycle of a society, is that you're raising individuals who are relationally impoverished but hungry to be filled. Mm-hmm. And then there's a upper class with power that is promoting the consumption of needless goods to fill that gap, but as you point out, only temporarily, right? And so you want more, and then you want more, and you want more, and you're told that you should have more bling and you should have more this.
Right.
But the reality is what you need is more neighbors. You need more people. You need more music. You need more dance. You need more touch. You need more, you know, you need to be with people and belong and be connected. And that's what makes you healthy.
You said in the book, as we kind of wrap up, that emotions. Well, you do a whole thing on regulation. I guess I'm not sure if we're going to have time to get on that, but you talked about emotion. The emotions of people around us is contagious.
Yeah.
And you give this example about a little girl in the airport and how she gets a gruffy man to smile, et cetera, et cetera. Does that work both ways?
Yeah.
If everybody's angry.
Oh, and I'm angry. Works.
And if everybody, so how do we intervene and move this, or how do you all intervene and move people in another direction when you're doing the work that you're doing, whether it's in Ukraine Uvalde or Chicago?
I think the key, and I think anybody who's been a teacher, and you can talk to your family members who've been teachers, they'll tell you examples of this. If they stay regulated, if they stay calm and they go into an unruly classroom, they can calm down. The kids will literally calm down with them. And you've probably seen this in your own home. Like, you have a bad day and you come home and you're in a bad mood, and it's, there's like sort of the witching hour when you come home. But if you can stay calm, if you take care of yourself, that's one of the key things, is if you give yourself a chance to work out, listen to new music, spend time with your friends, take care of yourself, and then you're going to be able to better stay regulated to then be the if you will, the anchor for the people around you to sort of feel safe and regulated. And there's a parallel process So if you are out and you are a marginalized, disrespected, unemployed father who, again, is sort of minimized and marginalized, didn't get hired again, he goes home, it's very hard for that person to be completely calm, completely regulated, completely present for his family. And right. So that impacts, you know, the poverty that he is experiencing impacts his family.
Wow.
And this is why it's important for us to recognize that economic housing interventions actually are good for your mental health.
Right, you know, basic needs.
Exactly. If you take care of the fundamental needs and support the cultural development of a community, you will make the entire community healthier. Children will do better in school. There'll be less diabetes. There'll be less alcoholism. There'll be less drug use. There'll be less violence. It really, you cannot separate these bigger infrastructure, these bigger policy-related issues from individual health. And that's something that we have been hammering away at, trying to get people to understand, but we still tend to fragment, you know, we have all these silos of here's mental health, here's physical health, here's education, and then here's housing. And the incoherence about policymaking between them contributes to the problem. So
we've been talking with Dr. Bruce D. Perry. As we close out, I want to let you let people know how they can connect with you, one, and if they pick up the book, anything that you feel that they really need to pay attention to. You know, it's a good book. It's easy to read. It's not super duper clinical, even though you do some clinical stuff in terms of showing us how the brain operates and all that. So it's not something that is beyond the scope of most of us, you know, who pick it up. But anything that you want to let us know that, like, if you pick this up, pay attention to these two chapters, or, pay attention to this theme.
Here's what I would say, is that what both of us are trying to communicate and help people appreciate is that no matter what age you are, no matter what part of your life you're in, that you have a tremendous amount of power, that you are, your presence and your ability to care for other people is it's like a superpower. It will help you and it will help the person you interact with. And in the end, all of the positive change that's going to happen in our world is going to happen because individuals interact with other individuals in ways that are respectful, kind, compassionate, understanding, and really we're, as you probably see all the time, we're living in a really polarized society, a lot of anger, a lot of frustration. And the more that we can sort of take a breath and be present and kind to the people around us, the more we're going to be able to use that contagion to sort of decrease the, you know, turn the burner down a little bit so that, you know, not everybody's all boiling in this situation, because we're never going to solve problems. The other part of the book, you know, the more boiling there is, the more anger there is, the more we shut down the smartest part of our brain.
Right,
so we're never going to solve these problems until we can be compassionate and kind with each other, listen to each other, and then we can solve problems together.
One would say you have to have the presence and execution of justice for that to happen. Is that true?
I believe it is true. And that's why I think it's so important that we teach the real history.
Right.
We not only know what happened to you, but what happened to us. How do we get here? How do we get to this place? And if we look at that squarely and tell the truth, then we'll be at a good place where we can start to make some positive change.
Dr. Bruce Perry, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. His organization, childtrauma.org. And as you mentioned at the start of the show, they been on the front lines doing a lot of work, Chicago, Uvalde, Ukraine, and in places beyond. Pick up the book. Which is a good read, you know, what happened to you, and it's conversations on trauma, resilience, and healing. And it's by him and Oprah Winfrey. We didn't even talk about Oprah, but that we'll save that for another, another
That's a whole show.
That's a whole show unto itself. But she has a presence in the book, and she, you know, throughout.
Oh, yeah, she's amazing.
You know, she kind of enters into the chapters with kind of vignettes and interviews. And then you all start breaking stuff down. So it's a good read. Thank you, Dr. Bruce Perry.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take a break on Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man. Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout out to Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah.
Stand up. Ensemble, Big Knock Woo.
Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue.